May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in thy sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Please be seated. Some years ago, I was listening to a cassette tape, I can tell how long that was in the past, by Fred Craddock, who was a preaching professor at Emory at that time at the Methodist Seminary. And he said something so good, I pulled over and wrote it down. And it's about the parables. This is one of Jesus' parables in the gospel today. Jesus told these stories with a surprise of grace that alerted, offended, and caused many to go around with their clipboards and pencils, chewing their erasers and comparing notes and scribbling and saying, I don't think I got the point of that. Well, today's parable is like that for me. It's like following Jesus around with a clipboard and chewing on the eraser saying, I don't think I got the point of that. Now, I don't know which Bible you read from, but most Bibles have paragraph divisions, and the editors who put the Bibles together for printing put little superscriptions over the columns to give you a summary of what you're about to read. You have to watch those superscriptions. If you have three different Bibles, it might do you well to compare them to one another, because sometimes the superscription sets you up to misread what follows, because it's an editor's interpretation of what follows. And in this case, most gospel translations have something like the dishonest steward or the unjust steward up there to tell you what this parable is about. But if you read the parable itself, going through about verse 9, you can't find the word dishonest or unjust in there. And the interpreters are all over the map on this one. If you want to know what an opinion is, just read a commentary, and the next one will be different because nobody can seem to make sense of it. What I would like to do today is to take the word dishonest or unjust off the table and just look at these two people in light of this parable and ask ourselves the question, what is the issue here? Now, the early church had trouble with this parable too. The original parable probably ends somewhere around where he says the master commended the steward. And you know all those other sentences that are strung down below there? It's like, wow. Well, those are sayings of Jesus that in other places are scattered in the Gospels, but Luke sort of collects them all here as an attempt to explain this parable, and they don't really work very well when you just look at the parable itself. What do we learn from this man? Well, first of all, the amounts in the story are huge. It's 800 gallons of olive oil. It takes 150 trees to make that much olive oil, and it's 1,200 bushels of wheat. So what the impression is we get is that the owner here is a wealthy landowner, and he's got so much land that he can't directly collect all of the produce from the peasant farmers who farm it for him. So he depends on wholesalers. The wholesalers make a contract with the landowner for how much they will deliver. And in the ancient Middle East, there was always bargaining and quibbling and exploitation, because the profit the wholesaler got is how much he could get from the peasant farmers above his contract. Well, the manager is the guy who runs the show for the wealthy landowner. He makes his living by negotiating contracts with the wholesalers, and his profit is what he can get above the contract. So there's all sort of room for all kinds of graft and corruption and exploitation. It's not like modern Western American capitalism, where everything's in a contract written down. So we don't know exactly what's going on here. You wouldn't be surprised if I told you that church has an onstage and church has a backstage. You know, the rumors and the gossip and the accusations go on backstage, and what's onstage is what everybody sees. Well, this parable has a backstage. We don't know who made the accusation against him. Maybe it was the wholesalers. And all they say is he's scattering your possessions, wasting them, or living indiscreetly. It's the same word used in the parable of the prodigal son for the younger son who goes off and spends everything he inherited. So the best we can do in guessing is that this manager is doing such a good job of negotiating these contracts, and he's maybe living a little bit indiscreetly, driving a BMW instead of driving a Volkswagen. And there's jealousy the wholesalers are jealous because he's doing so well, and it's a little bit of an embarrassment to his boss when the boss finds out how well he's doing, and it's a shame to him. So it's not so much that he's dishonest, it's just that he's done a really good job of making money and he's living a little bit high on the hog, so he loses his job. And he's perplexed. He knows that he's not physically strong enough to go out and dig with the peasants. I'm not strong enough to dig. And if he goes out and tries to do manual labor, he's going to break down physically, and then he'll end up being a beggar, and he's too proud to beg. So he's thinking, what do I do? And he decides, since these contracts don't specify how much is principal and how much is interest, it's just a sum amount, and it's supposed to be illegal to charge interest according to Deuteronomy and Leviticus, but they're doing it anyway, so they hide the interest in the principal. And it's as much as 25 to 50%. So he decides he'll just take the interest out of the contracts, which makes him look really righteous and holy because he's obeying the law. And it means the wholesalers are getting a break. And he's counting on getting another job, you know, out of this. So he takes the interest out. Instead of 800 barrels of oil, you owe me 400. Instead of 1,200 bushels of wheat, you owe me 800. What do we learn from this? The master commended him. Now, probably the owner could be Jesus in the original text, because he was shrewd. He learned, he was capable of thinking ahead. If you drive around in a community and see a new bank under construction or a new CVS pharmacy, you know why it's going up? They've done their demographic research and they know customers are coming. And Jesus says the sons of this generation are wiser for their generation than are the children of light. Shouldn't we, aided by God's wisdom, be able to outthink the world and anticipate and make our plans for the future as the church? That's the idea. And not getting hung up in needs. You know, the church needs this or the church. That's not what BB&T is doing, and that's not what CVS is doing. The community needs this. And if we provide it, we'll profit. So why would we want to get hung up and paralyzed by what we need? For example, we could say, we need more educational space. Well, right up the hill, there's a building. It's really big. And there's 3 acres of land up there. And we can say, well, we just don't have the money to fix it. We need the money. Well, let's think about that another way. We have this wonderful asset up here, 3 acres of land and a wonderful building, and we have people in this church who really care about Christian education and serving the community and having enough space to meet our church's programming and ministry. So we have assets. And we think about Jesus and the feeding of the 5,000. If they got hung up on just the 2 loaves and the 5 fishes, the feeding would never have happened. Jesus said, what do you have? 5 loaves and 2 fishes, and that's enough. And Jesus is saying to us, what do you have as a church? Whatever we have, with God's grace, is enough. If we just don't get hung up about our needs as the church. I love one of Reinhold Niebuhr's prayers about the future. Oh God, who has made us creatures of time, so that every tomorrow is unknown country and every decision of venture and faith, grant us, frail children of the day, who are yet blind to the future, to move toward it in the sure confidence of your love, from which neither life nor death can ever separate us. So we've got 5 loaves and 2 fish around St. John's. Is it enough? What about the owner? Here's a guy with a real sense of humor. He sort of gets outwitted here. He's a little bit embarrassed about how well his manager is living and how shrewd he's been, so he decides he's going to get rid of him and sort of calm the complaints that are coming in, and his manager turns the tables on him and reduces the interest on the debts so that the wholesalers are now all of a sudden, they're always complaining about something. You know, all of a sudden they don't have that to complain about anymore. The man looks so generous because of his manager. Now the owner could have retaliated against his manager, but he didn't. He just laughed. How shrewd of him. So there's something to be learned from this wealthy man about power and vulnerability. He didn't exercise his power, he simply accepted his vulnerability. You got me. Now, on Sundays, the priest stands this way. And I don't know if anyone's ever talked to you about what that means. It's called the Oran's position during collects and the Great Thanksgiving, where you spread your hands in prayer as Jesus spread his on the cross. Because when you're in this position, you're not protecting your heart. It's a position of open vulnerability, which is the place we're called to be as the church. Not exerting retaliation against people who wrong us, that's not Jesus' way. The way of Jesus and God is like a sponge soaking up blood, or a heart receiving a spear. There's no retaliation. God has understood that the only way to overcome evil is to absorb it in a willing human heart and not retaliate. That's what the cross is about, and that's how we're called to live. Now, granted, if you're the victim of abuse, you want to find a way to end the abuse that you're receiving and get away from it without retaliating against the abuser. And granted, there are some people in the church who have this recurring tendency to be vindictive or angry. So if you spread your arms and become open to them, you get punched in the chest a lot. So you sort of learn to stay arm's length away from those people so that when they punch, the fist doesn't get there. But you're still in the position of trying to be forgiving and loving without being dumb about the personalities of some people. Simone Weil has put it this way: whoever takes up the sword shall perish by the sword, and whoever does not take up the sword or lets it drop shall perish on the cross. And that is our calling, to bear the cross. So this man reminds us about the need to be vulnerable. The same window that lets in the rain and the wind also lets in the sun and the cool breeze. So if we close the window to keep out the rain and nail it shut, the breeze cannot get in. The only way to receive the blessing of other people's love is to be vulnerable to the pain they may inflict. And in the same way, opening that same window to God. If we close the window on each other, we have, without realizing it, closed the window that lets God in. And so today, let's sort of banish the word need from our vocabulary and replace it with wisdom and a spirit of entrepreneurial expectation. We've got 5 loaves and 2 fishes. That's plenty. And let us live our lives this way and not this way. Dorothy Soleil wrote a poem about vulnerability, and I'll just share a few lines in closing. My skin is a window of vulnerability. Without moisture, without touching, I must die. We need light so we can think. We need air so we can breathe. We need a window open toward heaven. Amen.